Well, good morning, Sanctuary Columbus. I am so grateful to be able to share with you today. I am so grateful for Pastor Rich for giving me this chance to speak on such an important weekend where we are celebrating Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So I am a beloved daughter of the Most High God, who is a sociologist and a scholar of race and Christianity in America. And so a good deal of what I'm going to be sharing with you today is really informed by my calling and my expertise in this arena. Now, as a sociologist, I would have to say I believe I am in really good company. I don't know how many of you know this, but Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. majored in sociology when he was at Morehouse College. And so one cannot help but reflect on who he is, connecting that sociologist background as well as being a reverend, and how he brought that into his ministry when it comes to race, truth, and justice, particularly when we're thinking about this moment. Now, many people, when they do think of Dr. Martin Luther King, they think of his "I Have a Dream" speech. One of the most repeated lines of this speech is, "I have a dream that little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers." Now, don't get me wrong. This is a beautiful vision, right? But what is quite perplexing, if one is familiar with King's "I Have a Dream" speech, is that somehow this line has come to represent the essence of the speech. Somehow, "I Have a Dream" has morphed into simply a call for diversity. But upon a closer listening to the entirety of the speech, one cannot help but grasp that his message was fundamentally about freedom and justice, about the undoing of a racially oppressive system. "I Have a Dream" was a proclamation that it is time for freedom and justice now, not tomorrow, not sometime in the undetermined future, but now. Dr. King was keenly aware that not everyone understood the fierce urgency of now, something he regularly spoke of as he addressed the importance of the struggle for freedom. But there was one group that he had earnestly hoped would not only understand the urgency of the moment, but partner in the struggle to spread the gospel of freedom. He himself explains, "I felt that the white ministers, priests, and rabbis of the South would be among our strongest allies." But instead, King found himself in 1963 sitting in a dingy jail cell in Birmingham, Alabama. He had been the leader of the civil rights movement for 8 years by this time, and admittedly disappointed, perhaps even a bit despondent, he is responding to the letter of a group of white ministers who refer to the nonviolent resistance of civil rights movement participants as unwise and untimely. None too pleased at the campaign for change that had emerged in Birmingham in 1963, these ministers made their views clear in writing, declaring, "We respectfully urge those who strongly oppose desegregation to pursue their convictions in the courts, and in the meantime, peaceably to abide by the decisions of those same courts." And they further asserted that, "We do not believe that these days of new hope are days when extreme measures are justified in Birmingham." People's perspectives are everything, are they not? They saw that 1963 was a day of new hope. "The courts will bring forth justice," they said. These ministers urged King and others in the movement to place their trust in a system that had been responsible for engaging in, or at least supporting, the killing, beating, thwarting, denying, rejecting, segregating, and dehumanizing of blacks and other people of color namely American Indians, since the U.S. was even a nation, even before that. For sure, the Supreme Court had ruled with Brown v. Board of Education that racially segregated schools were unconstitutional 9 years prior. But in reality, on the ground, in 1963, schools were still overwhelmingly segregated in the South, and Black children and adults remained severely disadvantaged. King's response to this criticism, as outlined in his letter from a Birmingham jail, is an amazingly eloquent example of a mix of love and truth. He speaks with respect, care, and humility, while also standing firm in the truth, resisting compromise and its counterfeit promises that can sometimes tempt us to equivocate and render the truth we do speak powerless. Pointing out a flaw in these white ministers' plea, he writes, "You deplore the demonstrations taking place in Birmingham, but your statement, I am sorry to say, fails to express a similar concern for the conditions that brought about the demonstrations. It is unfortunate that demonstrations are taking place in Birmingham, but it is even more unfortunate that the city's white power structure left the Negro community with no alternative." Do not these words sound so apropos today as people continue to protest for the dignity of Black life? This was a white power structure where, as King described, quote, "local racists intimidated, mobbed, and even killed Blacks with impunity, where churches and homes were being bombed and there was no justice to be had. And yet, these white ministers said the movement was unwise and untimely and encouraged the oppressed to have hope in the oppressor." I want to emphasize something here, actually, that often gets lost as we talk about reconciliation or inequality. And that is what King refers to in his book, Why We Can't Wait, the white power structure. You see, a white power structure is a social system, one that has been cultivated and spread throughout not only this country, but that has been cultivated and spread throughout the globe since the expansion of European colonization that began in the 16th century. It is a system based upon the creation of race and the perpetuation of race. Now, often people try to minimize race to groupings or identities, but race isn't just about categories or identities. No, race is a system. And the white power structure King referred to is a system of white supremacy. Now, recently, we are hearing more and more about this in the public arena. And for sure, it is important to name the racial system we are talking about here. That is white supremacy, because language matters. And there are times when certain language is just insufficient because it does not tell the truth, or at least not the whole truth. And half-truths are lies, are they not? So, what is white supremacy? Well, white supremacy is a racial system that rests in the belief that white people are superior to all other people. Okay, superior in what, you ask? Well, superior in all the ways that really matter. But what ways really matter? Well, those that white people in power decide really matter. And you say, "Dr. Corey, that answer doesn't make any sense." No, it doesn't, but neither does white supremacy. White supremacist societies have emerged and are sustained in one of two ways. The first way is through force. People in power who became white by their own design decide that people in their minds who looked different from them were in some other way were inferior, an inferior race of people, not white. Due to their supposed inferiority as a race, they were not worthy of having power. And often this meant power over land they were actually living on, power to make decisions about their own lives, power over their own bodies, power to just exist. Moreover, it was believed that white supposed superiority was by divine design. Since God designed it this way, it is white people's manifest destiny to have all the power. And if that has to happen by force, well, then so be it. Now, I'm not going to spend time reviewing in detail the sociological and historical legacy of how white supremacy was established by force. There are many, many books that you can read on this topic, but briefly, we can just point to the systems of slavery and Jim Crow. The policies and laws that legitimated the genocide and segregation of American Indians. Citizenship laws that said only white people could naturalize as citizens, and so on, and so on, and so on. But there's a bit of a problem here. You see, the problem with white supremacy by force is it requires a whole lot of resources in human life, in money, in energy, in time, and that includes the resources of white people. So white supremacy by force actually is not sustainable. The other way white supremacy reigns is through white hegemony. White hegemony is the preferred way of sustaining white supremacy. So, what is white hegemony more specifically? Well, white hegemony is a white supremacist system where white dominance and the ideologies, theologies, norms, and values that sustain it are taken for granted by whites and people of color. Okay, let me say that again. White hegemony is a white supremacist system where white dominance, that is, whites near complete control, their ideologies, that is, their views about how the world should work, their theologies, that is, their ideas about the character and nature of God, their norms, that is, how people ought to behave, and values that sustain it, that is to say, what they consider to be important, are taken for granted by whites and people of color. Now, a white supremacist society that is hegemonic is on autopilot. The vast majority of people, whether white or not, accepts or is resigned to the reality that people of color are, for instance, disproportionately unemployed, make less money, have considerably less wealth, have less freedom, are put in jail or prison at far higher rates than whites, are more likely to live in the less desirable neighborhoods, occupy relatively few positions of real power, are disproportionately relegated to less desirable jobs, and are killed without justice. Now, often when we talk of race, the focus is actually on people of color. And this is something that's been going on for a long time. And I'll take you to The Souls of Black Folk by W.E. Du Bois, published in 1903. And W.E. Du Bois is considering how people of color are often situated as a problem. W.E. Du Bois. And he writes this in the book. They, whites, approach me in a half-hesitant sort of way. They eye me curiously or compassionately. And then instead of saying directly, how does it feel to be a problem? They say, I know an excellent colored man in my town. Or, do not these southern outrages make your blood boil? How does it feel to be a problem? I answer a seldom word. And yet, being a problem is a strange experience. So even white people who were sympathetic to the cause of colored people at that time, perceived people of color, black people specifically, as a problem to be solved. To put it another way, black people were objectified. They were not seen as equals to work side by side with, or dare I say to submit to, but were people to help. Black people were projects, and that too is objectification and dehumanizing. But what Du Bois came to understand in his development as a scholar is that at the center of white supremacy isn't the understanding of the souls of Black folk or people of color, but rather understanding what it means to be white, which he wrote about in his piece, The Souls of White Folk. So what is whiteness? Whiteness is distinguished from both white supremacy and white hegemony in that it encompasses white identity, and that white identity has meaning too. And when I say white here, I'm particularly talking about Anglos. Now, to be white is to be able to live in a society where whites' dominance and culture are presumed to be normative, just the way things are and ought to be, in fact. To be white is to go about life with the belief that you're right, you know better, at least better than people of color. To be white also means to be oblivious to one's race. That is, if you're white, other groups have a race, but you and other whites are actually, for all intents and purposes, raceless. And this is the slippery part. If the vast majority of white people see themselves as raceless, then to be white doesn't really mean anything. And if to be white doesn't really mean anything, then there is no white hegemony. And if there is no white hegemony, then there is no white supremacy. And this is precisely why the struggle for freedom for people of color in the United States has been so challenging. And this is precisely why it makes people uncomfortable when whiteness and the privileges it bestows are named. Because the hiddenness of whiteness is the linchpin of the white supremacist system. But it takes people who are willing to see the system for what it is, to stand firm against it and to speak the truth about it over and over and over again in hopes of spreading the gospel of love and freedom. By 1963 in Birmingham, King had come to an unfortunate reality. So often, he writes, the church is an arch defender of the status quo. Far from being disturbed by the presence of the church, the power structure of the average community is consoled by the church's silent and often even vocal sanction of things as they are. King expresses his disappointment in the church. He expresses his disappointment in the church and how it reinforces the status quo. To put it in terms I'm talking about here, his disappointment was in how the church reinforces white supremacy. The reason I emphasize that the real issue is a system, not people, as did King, is because that is in fact the problem. And if we are going to be honest, really honest, we know that if we stand and choose to speak out against white supremacy, then the system of white supremacy will respond, often violently. That response is not just reserved for people of color. That is to say, a person's whiteness will not protect them once they break the code of silence or just going along and begin to disrupt white supremacy. White people who have stood firm in an effort to spread the gospel of love and freedom in a way that disrupts white supremacy experience consequences. These may be loss of friendship. Maybe their family ostracizes them. Perhaps their church makes it clear they are not wanted in this fellowship. Maybe they lose opportunities at work. It can also mean physical harm or even death. Our history has shown this to be the case. And today, in this moment, yet again, we're hearing of these same outcomes. We're again seeing this play right out now in this historical moment. Pastors, including white ones, are being fired for speaking out about justice. White saints are losing friends, family relationships are being strained, and some whites have been killed because they chose to stand and march for Black lives. On the flip side, people of color can and do support white supremacy. In that letter from the white Birmingham ministers to King, they note Blacks who were not supportive of the civil rights movement demonstration, saying, "We agree rather with certain local Negro leadership who has called for honest and open negotiation of racial issues in our area. Now, who these Black leaders are, we're not sure. And it doesn't matter much. And quite frankly, it's not surprising that in a system of white supremacy, people of color will cooperate with the status quo. I mean, if white people will experience harm, whether that be social or psychological or physical, for challenging white supremacy, then you know people of color will and do. We have for centuries. We don't have some kind of innate resistance to pain, trauma, and harm. We too choose to self-protect by supporting the system of white supremacy. I often joke that God is a sociologist, although I actually do believe that. And that is because God would often call entire nations to task for their sin. And that can make us a bit uncomfortable, particularly in an individualistic society like the United States. And this is a common occurrence, though, throughout Scripture. When the Lord, through the prophets, called out Israel for being a thoroughly unjust society that set up systems that oppress the powerless, do we think everyone was equally culpable in the creation of Israel's unjust, oppressive system? I'm guessing, although I cannot be sure, there are some people in Israel who maybe, and even most people, who weren't actively oppressing the powerless. I'm guessing rather that these people just didn't say anything. They were silent. They turned a blind eye. But what strikes me is God, through Isaiah, did not single out those who were egregiously unjust or unrighteous. He called out the whole nation. And you know what? The rough times were prophesied to come down on everyone. The Lord, through the prophet Isaiah in chapter 5, said, "He looked for judgment, but behold oppression. For righteousness, but behold a cry." And then after that, well, come the woes. And I'm not talking about the woe. You know, I'm talking about woes. And for the sake of time, let's just say woes are not good. My point here is not to prophesy impending doom. I don't know the future. And no doubt, taking a stand and speaking up and disrupting the status quo takes tremendous courage. Silence is easier, even personally safer, at least in the short run. And the question I ask is, though, no matter how afraid we may be to stand, to speak, can our fear justify our silence, our inaction? Silence is approval. Silence is culpability. King put it this way: the ultimate tragedy is not the oppression and cruelty by the bad people, but the silence over that by the good people. And while this can be a hard thing to hear, it doesn't change the reality. King and others in the civil rights movement fought the battle of Jim Crow. And in many respects, they won. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and Fair Housing Act of 1968 are victories won in that battle. These victories have impacted how we do life, who we work with, live near, see on the streets, go to school with, sit near in public places, and how we are represented in government, among a myriad of other changes. And I am truly grateful for these victories. But the war was against the white power structure, not Jim Crow. That was the case before Jim Crow, and that remains the case today. White supremacy is still weaved into the very fabric of American society. There is not a part of American society that is altogether free of it. Often hidden, white supremacy has yet again, though, become visible. And so, the war wages on. This isn't a war of physical weapons, but a war of the spirit. A war for love, freedom, and truth. For those of us who choose to sign up for the war, we must find a delicate balance on this very taut tightrope of love and truth. We must treat oppressors with compassion, dignity, and respect, while never wavering in telling the truth, the whole truth. It is this balance that we must strike just right, one between love and truth, if we are to stand for freedom and justice as followers of Christ. Being loving without truth leads to error. Because you see, when we sacrifice telling the whole truth, the oppressed are left in their oppressed state. Bondage persists. Injustice continues to reign. But without love, we can judge the oppressors and condemn them, something only reserved for the one that is all-knowing and all-powerful. There were many before King who led and fought in other battles in the war of love and truth against white supremacy. They got the fierce urgency of now for their time. There is Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Susan B. Anthony, A. Philip Randolph, Ida B. Wells. And since King, there's Clyde Bellecourt, Cesar Chavez, Gustavo Gutierrez, Alicia Garza, and many others. But I wonder, what if they didn't get in their gut a fierce urgency of now to speak, to act, to stand against the system of white supremacy? What if they placed their trust in time, just waiting it out? Me personally, I'm so very grateful they did not. So I wonder, do you have a fierce urgency stirring in you that the moment is now? Do you see God moving in this moment in history? Gustavo Gutierrez, a philosopher and priest, reminds us in his book, The Theology of Liberation, that to grasp the very meaning of Christianity requires us to acknowledge the historical arc of humankind. It requires a sight that God is working in and through all human action on earth. It is God's purpose that humans be free, for Jesus says this directly in Luke 4:18. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free. And then later in Galatians, Paul puts it this way: it was for freedom that Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery. Gutierrez highlights how freedom is God's expression of love. And he puts it this way when he's referring to Bonhoeffer, that the fullness of liberation, a free gift from God, is communion with God and with other human beings. And then, in truth, freedom is a relationship between persons. That being free means being free for the other. We are to be looking to be free for the other in service. What I appreciate about Gutierrez's explication, as well as that of another theologian, including Howard Thurman and, of course, Martin Luther King Jr., is that they understood deep in their souls that God intends us to be fully free, that freedom ought to extend to our whole being, our souls, our minds, our bodies. Indeed, the beloved community is one where people are fully free to live out their giftedness and experience mutual love with God and neighbor. How then can freedom and love be achieved in a world where systems of poverty, injustice, and oppression are allowed to persist? It cannot be so. The church mustn't be the church of the status quo, but the church in pursuit of love and freedom for all humankind. For our God says that he so loves the world. Many place their hope in government and political officials. But really, this moment is not about the government. This is a moment for the church to repent. We're needed and stand united. It is the moment to stand together as the empowered, spirit-filled children of the Almighty God against the white supremacist system of today. In love and truth together, Black brothers and sisters,
white brothers and sisters, Latinx brothers and sisters, Asian brothers and sisters, American Indian brothers and sisters, those who are Methodist, ECC, AME, National Baptist, Catholics, Lutherans, Presbyterians, Baptists, Episcopals, Lutherans, Pentecostals, Kojic, Assemblies of God, non-denominational, and other affiliations, this is the moment for the church. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., at the young age of 26, followed that stirring of a fierce urgency of now. My hope is we won't allow that fire to die, but that together we would seize our moment and fan the flames of the fierce urgency of now at this historical juncture to speak and stand for the love and freedom and truth found in Jesus Christ our Lord.